Marcus Agrippa, The March to Actium, Part 1. Now this will take us all the way until the failure of Antony and his Parthian invasion. So we're going to break this up in the little segments. We're finally going to get to the main piece, because usually, when I teach world history, and I get to Rome, and we assassinate Julius Caesar, we have the battle between the Second Triumvirate and the Assassins, a short division of the territory between the three, and then we start the process of the battle between Antony and, of course, Octavian. So we've covered a lot of ground that filled in that gap. Of course, while Octavian and Agrippa were working hard to bring order to the Balkans and winning over the hearts and minds of the Roman people at home, Antony was fighting wars of his own in the East, but intent on winning the heart of a single woman. Separated by distance and time, Octavian and Antony continued their friendship through official correspondence with each other, but shared private confidences by letter with their mutual friend and Agrippa's father-in-law, Atticus. They were still brothers-in-law, but their relationship, which had always been one of political convenience, had changed. Imperator Caesar Octavian was now ambitious for power for himself and desired to be chief, not just merely of the city of Rome, but the whole Roman world. Well, Antony, of course, is basically a free agent. Since Brundisium, when the triumvirs had carved up the world between them, Antony had subsumed himself in his exotic territory. He reorganized the provinces in Asia and Greece, formed a close relationship with the many kingdoms and princedoms which were allies of Rome. Antony was a natural networker. He was careful to court the favors of client kings who ruled the region. These include Bacchus, king of Lydia, Trachimonides, king of Upper Cilicia, Archelaus, Cappadocia, Philadelphios, Paraphilonia, Mithridates of Cremange, Sadalus of Thrace, Polemon I of Pontus, Malchus of Arabia, Amythus, king of Laconia and Galatia, and Herod, king of the Jews. In return for his personal support, which might mean representing them at the Senate in Rome if a charge was brought or sending an army to help fend off an enemy, these client kings were obligated to provide financial and military assistance when Antony, as of course the ranking Roman official, called for it. It was an arrangement which suited national leaders whose situation was often precarious without the backing of a major alliance partner. And of course it suited Rome, which did not have to incur the overhead cost of occupying these territories. Herod exemplified how a client king could rule with Roman support. He was the second son of Antipater I, the high-ranking official employed by the leader of the Judean Hyrcanus II of the Hasmonean dynasty, who appointed him governor of Galilee when he was in his mid-20s. After Julius Caesar's assassination, Antipater was forced to side with Cassius Longus against Mark Antony. However, his pro-Roman politics led him to become increasingly unpopular among the devout non-Hellenized Jews. Herod's father was murdered by poisoning, and with the backing of the Roman authorities, he hunted down and executed Antipater's murderer, quickly earning a deserved reputation for cruelty, one which he will continue to have grow. After the Battle of Philippi, Herod, then 31 years old, took a chance by showing personal support for the victors, and by doing so, gained the support of Antony. When the triumvir marched into Asia, he appointed Herod Tetrarch of Galilee, one of the two administrative districts in Judea. In 40 or 39 BCE, with the help of the Parthians, Antigonus II Matthias, son of King Aristobulus II, took the throne from his uncle Hyrcanus II by force, hoping to establish an independent Jewish state. Seeking the help of his Roman sponsor to restore his position, Herod sailed west in a hurry to Brundisium and traveled to Rome. With the support of Octavian and Antony, he addressed the Senate, arguing that Antigonus was the real enemy and convinced the conscript fathers to recognize him. After all, he was a loyal friend of the Romans, and he wanted to be the legitimate king, the ethnarch of the Jews. After returning to his country and winning a brutal three-year war, Herod reclaimed his seat, became the sole ruler of Judea. Captured by force, Antigonus was hauled away in chains and sent to Antony along with cash and treasure confiscated from the supporters of the Parthian puppet. Herod had demonstrated he knew who his friends were. Sextus Pompeius, of course, was not so fortunate. He had fled and sought asylum with Antony in 35 BCE. On landing at Miletus in Anatolia, he was arrested, perhaps acting on direct orders from Antony, or Muntius Plancinus, his deputy, Titus, had him killed. His execution was an illegal act, as all Roman citizens were entitled to a trial. And whether or not Antony was behind it, the ancient historians are split on whether he was. And this matter would come to haunt him later. At his core, Antony was a soldier, and a very proud soldier. It was said he believed there was no better death for him than by battle. As governor general in the East, he sought to settle an old score. He conceived a military campaign against Rome's nemesis, Parthia. It was motivated by a desire to restore the national honor after Crassus's humiliating defeat at Carrhae in 53 BCE by Orodes II and the Parthian incursions led by the Labienus on behalf of King Pacorus I in 40 BCE. After 2 years, Antony had assembled an army of his own troops, supplemented by men and material from client kings and allies. At the start of his campaign, he had 60,000 Roman infantry, together with 10,000 Celtiberian cavalry, 30,000 assorted soldiers, counting alike horsemen and light armored troops from allies. Yet he complained that he was still short of troops. He had been promised by Octavian in return for the ships he had provided for the Sicilian War against Sextus Pompey. Antony would have to bolster his numbers by calling on Rome's sole ally in the region. North of the Parthian provinces of Mesopotamia lay the great state of Armenia, which was ruled by Artavades II, son of Tigranes the Great. Artavanes II had been an ally of the Romans, but when they were defeated at Carrhae, he was forced to switch sides. Seeing an opportunity to free himself from Parthian obligations, he switched sides again, this time allying himself with Antony. On the advice of Artavades II of Armenia, Antony planned to invade Parthia from the north, not from the west. By invading the Parthian client kingdom to the east of Armenia, called Media Atropatae, bordering on the Caspian Sea, which was ruled by Artavades I, no relation to the Armenian, by the way, and the royal ally of the Parthian king, Phantres IV, Antony's decision was fateful. His advance with 13 legions reached Parsippa, the strongly fortified capital of Media Atropatae. According to Plutarch, the siege engines, which required 300 wagons to transport them, as well as a giant battering ram, would be needed to capture the walled city. He decided to leave it behind. According to Velius Paterculus, Antony lost 2 legions and their siege equipment to the Parthians. There his campaign halted. Unable to take the town, Antony now found himself exposed on the plain outside the city. The Parthians soon came to the aid of Artavades, who was holed up in his city. They attacked Antony's supply train, and when the rations were cut, his own soldiers mutinied. His fair-weather ally, Artavades I of Armenia, deserted him. Undaunted, in October of that year, Antony demanded that the Parthians return the eagle standards and the Roman prisoners they had taken. The Parthians refused and replied that they would only permit him to leave the region unmolested. Without leverage, Antony could do no more than accept the terms and ordered his army to head back to Syria. Before departing, he received a tip-off that he should expect an ambush, and to avoid it, he decided to take a route over the mountains. He was pursued by the Parthians, and through 25 brutally harsh days, Antony struggled to lead his men to safety. After withering attacks, he finally reached Antiochia on the Orontes in Syria. The failed campaign had come at a terrible cost. 20,000 infantry, 4,000 of the cavalry had died, and most of them not at the hands of the enemy. More than half of them died as a result of disease. They had indeed marched 27 days and had defeated the Parthians in 18 battles, but their victories were not complete or lasting because the missions they had pursued were ineffectual and short-term in outlook. So it was to some extent, I'm sure Antony didn't believe that the Parthians would be easy pickings for him, but he never really took them serious. And of course, having an ally that has known to switch sides, never know what's going on. This is a real blow, actually, to Antony's persona. He is quite depressed afterwards. Of course, Cleopatra will eventually come to his aid, and that will make him feel a lot better. So we'll go on to the next part with Cleopatra and the other issues that come about that draws us closer to the great battle of Actium. Now, the sources for this The Lives of the Caesars by Suetonius, The Annals of Imperial Rome by Tacitus, 12 Caesars by Grant, Cleopatra by Grant, Marcus Agrippa, the Right-Hand Man of Caesar Augustus by Powell. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.